Welcome to episode 302 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. Earlier this week, the U.S. Department of Energy released its Pathways to Commercial Liftoff Innovative Grid Deployment report, which found that grid-enhancing technologies, and that includes dynamic line ratings, advanced power flow control, and topology optimization, increases transmission capacity by making existing infrastructure more efficient. In short, the American power grid can do much more with what's already been built. This is important because modeling shows that U.S. electricity generation will need to grow 2 to 3 times by 2050 to accommodate the switch to electric technology like EVs and heat pumps. To discuss the report, I'm joined by Julia Selker, who is the executive director of the Watt Coalition. Welcome to the interview, Julia.
Thank you, Markham. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I've interviewed your colleague and Rob Gramlich a number of times about this, but it's been a while because it seems like 3, 4, 5 years that these grid-enhancing technologies have been in the conversation. I know your organization has been talking to government, lobbying government for support for them. And maybe we should start off with something really basic. What are grid-enhancing technologies?
Yeah, so they're technology, software, and hardware that get more capacity out of the existing grid and improve reliability and safety and other attributes at much lower cost and much faster than traditional infrastructure upgrades. They're also redeployable. So if you put a device in one place and use it for 6 months as you have an outage, you might be able to move it somewhere else if it's no longer useful there. So that's what gets us to that list of three technologies you mentioned. So dynamic line ratings are sensors that go on or near the power lines, and they measure the behavior of that power line and the ambient conditions that affect that behavior. So generally that's cooling impacts from wind or temperature. And those can see, it really depends on where the line is and what the weather is like, but those can see average capacity increases of over 40% in some cases. In Belgium, they've used DLR widely for many years, and they say they see over 20% capacity increase 90% of the time. So those are some data points. And then power flow control are devices that go at the substation and can push and pull power off of overloaded circuits and onto circuits that still have some capacity. And so that frees up more capacity that wasn't being used before. Topology optimization is like the Waze for the grid or Google Maps for the grid. It takes the whole system and looks at opportunities to reroute power through switching infrastructure at substations, for instance. Those reconfigurations, as they're called, can be kind of unintuitive. So in the past, we've used reconfigurations when a grid operator has kind of noticed how things work. But with topology optimization software, the operators can get this menu of options and choose to use them, you know, in outage coordination. If you have a line that has to take an outage, topology optimization can say, okay, if you flip this switch, you'll still get 80% of the capacity you had before, or something like that. So those are the technologies we work with.
I'm going to tell a little story. I love this story. I grew up in a little town called Gillam in northern Manitoba, which was the jumping off point for the construction of numerous hydroelectric dams on the Nelson River. It flowed into the Hudson Bay. It was very, very far up north. And my dad worked for Manitoba Hydro. And so as a hydro brat in the 70s, when I got my first job in high school in the summer, it was with Hydro working in the Radisson converter station. So the power comes out of the dam as AC, and it has to be converted to DC to be put on the lines to go 1,100 kilometers down to Winnipeg. And when, after high school, that was the first job I got, right? And I went to work in the clean room. Because back in those days, when that conversion, like these days, it all gets done with electronics. Back in those days, it was mercury arc valves. It was literally like young Frankenstein in the valve hall. They would arc between each other, and they would at night. It was just crazy. But that's the technology of the day. And it was very, now, of course, it's all very sophisticated. It's much better, but the heart, the very foundation of that transmission infrastructure dates back to the 50s and 60s. A lot of this stuff is really old, and it hasn't been modernized. And I understand it from my conversations with folks down in the U.S. It's actually, the U.S. grid is kind of old and creaky in a lot of places, and really was due for a major modernization. And it sounds like, with all of the NIMBYism and the problems with building infrastructure, that if you can repurpose what you have with better, new, modern technologies, that's gotta be the best, like the first choice, right?
Yeah, and there's also a transition going on with what generation we're using. I mean, even coal to gas and then gas to renewables. The generators aren't always where they were expected when the grid was built 50 plus years ago. So as the generators change locations, as the load changes locations, you want to use all the assets that are already there more dynamically and flexibly to address these changes. So you know, that's sort of a big picture look, but for each individual line, you know, by putting a dynamic line rating sensor on it, A, you know what it can actually carry, and B, you do get data that can help inform your planning decisions, where you build new transmission if you build it. So there's a lot to be said for modernizing our transmission technologies at this particular moment in time.
Let's talk about sensors and data. This is fascinating because this first came up on my radar in the oil and gas industry because, probably 2017, 2018, you know, a lot of what was going on in the oil field was like it had been done, you know, 30, 40, 50 years before. And a lot of, you'd have like pumpers that would drive around from pump jack to pump jack to pump jack, making sure they were okay. And they were starting to think, hey, you know, if we had these sensors that we could put on each pump jack, we could get data in real time, bring it back to headquarters, and we could monitor these things without having to drive around all over the countryside and run up costs and so on. And so the criticism at the time was that manufacturing had done this 20 years before. And then the oil field was just kind of get late to the game. Now, of course, you know, all of this stuff, they can't deploy this technology quick enough because it reduces the headcount, it reduces their costs, drives down their production costs. Is the power sector even later to the game?
Essentially, yes. One utility that deployed DLR, they initially put it on just to take data about their system, and then they found an opportunity where, you know, that extra capacity was actually really valuable. So they started using that extra capacity, but there's the system is essentially run on a lot of assumptions about, you know, how the lines will behave. And a lot of those assumptions are based on really conservative expectations. So if, say a utility is using a seasonal line rating, so they'll say, oh, okay, all summer, you know, the hottest it could get, it could be 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So let's operate all summer as if it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And then, you know, in the fall, suddenly you'll get a bunch more capacity just because it's the fall and we're using a different rating. So, using the true actual rating saves you money if you don't have to build more, and if you don't end up curtailing generation because you're like, oh, this line can't handle it. But then it also just, you know, you're operating the grid and you understand the capabilities of the grid accurately.
I have to chime in with another anecdote because you mentioned 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which is actually 50 degrees Celsius.
Helpful, thank you.
And for our Canadian and European listeners, you know, I was in Bakersfield, California one summer and coming out of a building at 50 degrees Celsius, 120 F is like being hit with a warm blanket hard. I mean, it is hot, but it does get that hot down there. I mean, it's basically the Mojave Desert, right? Or a desert in one form or another. Anyway, yeah. A little aside there for you just to date myself. The idea of collecting data that we're talking about, so sensors on transmission lines, that then gets us into the question of analyzing that data. Mm-hmm. And That then gets us into the question of artificial intelligence and data analytics and what you can do with it and predictive analytics, predictive maintenance, and all of that, that kind of stuff. And it sounds like this is relatively new to utilities, maybe some more than others, you know, because nothing gets, this is not a uniform industry. Mm-hmm. But is the rise of artificial intelligence and data centers a big help to the industry, given that they're moving towards grid-enhancing technologies?
Well, the dynamic line readings have been available since last century, you know, sort of in the 80s and 90s even, there was some version of dynamic line readings available. But since then, you know, there was a communications renaissance. So the level of the way that the data from the DLR sensors can get sent back to the utilities, the time, the way that even really remote locations can get the any data any time of the day, those sorts of advances have made this generation of DLR much more powerful than the last one. Even, you know, in 2008, the last time that the United States had a lot of grid modernization funding from the federal government. So there has been that transformation in terms of data centers and AI. I mean, even just a deterministic topology optimization calculation is a lot for the utilities to incorporate. This is already a leap. So as far as I know, these technologies largely aren't using AI. There's actually one DLR company that is using AI, but generally these are based on, you know, formulas that come out of IEEE. They're based on sensor data, and you know, it's all very you know, clear in that way. But the demand growth from AI and data centers, a lot of utilities are looking at that and thinking, you know, we can't build the infrastructure. And we hear from companies that are trying to build data centers, you know, the utilities are telling us it's going to take years to get the capacity that we need, the transmission capacity. So the value of these technologies is you can immediately unlock, you know, 20%+ more capacity on your system, and potentially way more than 20%. So it depends on the local grid and what's there already. So the response from utilities to load growth can be smoothed out a little bit if they adopt these tools.
Well, baby steps, Julia, baby steps. these engineers will get there. And you know what? I mean, we sometimes are hard on utilities because of their very conservative culture, engineering culture. But at the same time, I mean, you know, historically, we put a big emphasis on reliability, right? Keeping the lights on and keeping costs down. And so this paradigm shift that we're in now is hard on those utilities. And some of the cultures just don't change as quickly as others. And that's part of the issue, right?
Yeah. And it's, what do the utilities see their job as being? And what are they told that their job is? If it's to plan for, you know, peak demand and peak load, you know, they'll make one set of decisions. If it's to, you know, have the most efficient system and deliver the lowest cost energy all times of the year, they, you know, that's a much stronger case for these kinds of technologies. But in the United States, no one is directly responsible for that kind of efficiency. They're really responsible for reliability, and that's what they're planning for, and that's what they're operating for.
Is that one of the reasons why this report from the DOE is important?
Yeah, it puts some urgency behind changing that mindset and acknowledging that these tools are commercially available and can have some huge benefits. Definitely.
Is the DOE, because I love Jigar Shah. I follow him on LinkedIn and on Twitter, and the man is just he's a one-man evangelist team, right? You know, for all of these new technologies like virtual power plants, and he's starting to get behind this kind of technology. But the DOE, and it's not just him. That's the important thing. It's not just mm-hmm. him. The DOE appears to now see its mandate as evangelizing for modernization, for adoption of new technologies, of getting up the learning curve a lot quicker than the industry might, you know, were it left to its own devices. And it seems like, you know, because this is not the first commercial pathways to commercial liftoff report, right? There have been liftoff reports for other technologies. We interviewed DOE. Her name was, first name was Jennifer. And I'm going, of course, I'm going to forget her last name.
Granholm?
Anyway,
no.
Yes, yes, it was. Thank you very much. But anyway, she came out and talked about virtual power plants. And it seems like the DOE has emerged as this great champion of modernization and new technologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to speak for the Department of Energy, but I think they see their role as enabling a technological shift and faster adoption of these technologies. The liftoff idea is that, okay, there are these technologies that are commercially available, but they aren't being used to their full potential. What does it take for these technologies to reach a level playing field with all the other solutions that utilities are using? I think the thesis of the liftoff is that if we can have 6 to 12 flagship projects in the United States that really demonstrate the benefits and that lead utilities to do, you know, comprehensive integration of these tools into their systems, that'll be the sort of tipping point for when we get broader adoption, which I think is an interesting finding. You know, the WAAQ Coalition has been working on institutional inertia. And I think that, like, this idea that we can get several really strong projects out there and that will help address the system inertia makes a lot of institutional inertia makes a lot of sense. And then we've also been working on incentives, because utilities in the United States, investor-owned utilities, make their money when they own transmission on building more infrastructure. They get a percentage of the value of their system. So these really low cost technologies don't really make a difference on their balance sheet. And that feeds into the inertia, right? There's no reason to make this a priority if it's not going to make the company money. The liftoff report also talks about that problem and suggests pathways for regulators to change the incentives for utilities as well.
Right. And one of the technologies we want to talk about this is not a grid enhancing technology per se. It's not one of the three that we've been talking about, but we discussed it before the interview, and that is recabling or reconductoring. And essentially what that means is that, these cables are 50, 60, 70, maybe even years old or older, and they're just not as efficient. And apparently now, I am told by engineers in great more detail than I actually needed to hear it, that when you use modern cables and you replace the old ones with the new ones, you really boost the amount of electricity that can be sent through that infrastructure. So it seems to me that the three technologies you're talking about, the recabling, then there's a whole bunch of other sort of, you know, technologies like power electronics and other digital controls. This is really a revolution inside the U.S. power sector.
Yeah, I'll say reconductoring has been a practice in the utilities for a long time. So that's the good news, is that they already plan for that. That's already part of asset maintenance and replacement. The technologies that are emphasized in the liftoff report are advanced conductors or high performance conductors. And those usually have a different core. So, like, traditional cables have a steel core, and just like with dynamic line readings, the steel core, when it gets hot, it actually weakens and sags and can damage the line if it gets too hot. That's why there's a thermal rating. So with advanced conductors and a composite core, for instance, that core stays strong no matter what the temperature is, and you can actually wrap a lot more aluminum and more conductive aluminum. And maybe I'm getting into the engineering speak, that's too much, but you can put more conductive material on the line and you can reduce line losses. So the resistance in the line, actually, you know, the further you go, the less power comes out the other end. And then you can also increase the total current that can go along. So it's a great way to increase the capacity of existing corridors. You can sometimes reuse the old structures. So I know that some utilities have done live reconductoring where they didn't even have to take an outage somehow to put a new wire up. But usually I'll say reconductoring does require an outage. It does take a lot longer to do than installing gets. So that's why it's sort of a different category that than gets. And then also, you know, once you reconductor that line, that's where the capacity is, that's where it stays. And it's a more it's a constant capacity, unlike DLR. So utilities kind of, they can fit that into their models for how the grid is built. So that's the good news. They are a little more expensive, and that leads to some issues with our regulatory regime, where the regulators are only empowered to approve the lowest cost near-term solution rather than being able to look ahead sometimes. So there's unique challenges for advanced conductors, but hopefully they'll be used more and get more capacity out of the rights of ways we already have, which can take a long time to secure.
Indeed. And just as an aside, Julia, our listeners are very smart. We get a lot of scientists and engineers and, you know, folks who are in the industry. So you never have to worry about geeking out okay, on the great podcast. I wanted to bring up another issue that you alluded to just briefly, which is 6 to 12 flagship projects. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a theoretical basis in terms of technology adoption that underlies why you do this kind of thing. Mm. And it came out of work that was done at the University of Iowa in the 1930s. Mm. So they had this hybrid corn, which greatly increased the yields of corn crops in Midwestern U.S. And so what they thought, well, how are we going to get it out to the farmers? So what they did is they would go and they would find the most innovative, well-respected farmer in an area. And they would get him. It was always a him. I apologize for that, but it was the 30s. What can I tell you? And so they would get him to plant this hybrid corn. And then when it came time for harvest, they would get the surrounding farmers to come and they would have a farm day. And then they would have experts there to talk about the hybrid corn, and the farmers could talk to their neighbor and say, well, hey, you know, how was it to plant? And did it cause any other problems? And did it get bugs that we maybe didn't get? Blah, blah, blah. You know, farmer talk, right? You know, mm-hmm. And so they had, and then those farmers would then try it themselves and go, oh, this is great stuff. Now I'm going to use it. And it seems like those kind of flagship projects, I can see a utility doing it. And then you invite all the engineers from the surrounding utilities and you get them out there and they can ask questions, see it in operation for themselves and go, and then the lights go on. Mm-hmm. They go, aha, yep, that's how it works. I want that little tool, that new shiny new toy.
Definitely. Definitely agree with the DOE approach here. The one thing I disagree with is they say we should have those 6 to 12 projects in 3 to 5 years. And I think with grid enhancing technologies, we can have those 6 to 12 projects in the next year or two.
Okay.
Because we are really, the industry is ready, and we already have a few flagship projects, like AES Corporation is hosting a day-long workshop next week focused on grid enhancing technologies, and they have a deployment with 42 sensors, and they've just released a white paper on their dynamic line rating installation. So, you know, there are already utilities that are putting their hands up and saying, we're doing this, it's working, let's share our findings. So I think the liftoff report covered a lot of technologies, and I'm sure a few of them will need 3 to 5 years, but with GETS, I think we'll be there fast.
Now, it was just a few months ago that the NERC, the North American Electricity Reliability Council.
Corporation.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Released a report and warned about outages there, because what's happening is that utilities are retiring their thermal assets, their generators, faster than they can be replaced with wind, solar, and batteries, or even gas, whatever. But mm-hmm. we're retiring more quicker than what was anticipated, and it's causing problems with reserve capacity. That's the issue, and that could lead to more and more outages than we're accustomed to. So my question to you is, given the pace of change in the U.S. grid, the amount of solar and wind that's being installed, all of these technological changes, the new demand, the load increases that are coming after years of flat demand, is the industry showing signs that it can actually cope with all of this change?
That's a good question. I was just this week listening to a Southwest Power Pool presentation about GETS, and they used the example of their system on March 24th and 25th. They had basically maximum wind output forecast, and they had to curtail 7,000 megawatts
Oh,
of
wow.
that wind out of 22,000. That's almost half. For congestion mitigation, they lost 210 gigawatt hours of wind. So the transmission constraints are really holding back the renewable energy delivery in Southwest Power Pool under those conditions. So the generator retirements, whether they're happening fast enough or too slow, is one thing, but are we using all of the technologies that we can? Are we using the full capacity of the grid to make it work? Today, the answer is no. We have these technologies that have
Sure.
not been widely deployed. So that's where my head's at on that question.
Yeah, I can see why. I mean, we get this question in Canada, and I live in British Columbia where the grid is 97% hydro. So it's been stable and it's managed by a government-owned utility. One, it's a vertically integrated monopoly right from generation to distribution. Next door in Alberta, it's exact opposite. It's got the country's only wholesale market, open wholesale market. Anybody, in fact, the generation side is completely deregulated. So of course, plenty of wind and solar developers are were they were developing until the government put the kibosh on it. But that's another story that we've covered in other podcast interviews. My point here is, why do utilities continue to invest in wind and solar? And the answer is, it's cheap electricity. It's the cheapest electricity you could possibly, I talk to utility CEOs who say, look, I'm buying wind at a cent a kilowatt hour and solar at 2 cents a kilowatt hour. And all the trends on the cost curves are that that's going to be cheaper yet. We're approaching, the marginal cost of zero for electricity. Why wouldn't I? I'd be nuts not to do that. All these other problems like curtailment and my capacity constraints and in my transmission system, I can deal with those if I've got cheap power. And so that's why they do it. And now it's like we're playing catch up. We got the one technology that's out in front that everybody wants because it's cheap and we can manage it with battery storage and stuff. But now we've got to reconfigure the grid and re-engineer the grid and bring in all these other new technologies to kind of catch up to that. Is that a useful way of looking at this?
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that wind and solar are so cheap, and that's partially because they're, the developers, the independent power producers, for instance, are operating close to the margin. And so when they get hit with really hard congestion like this, they're losing money,
Right.
So it's also existential for the industry. Like, we need to make sure we are using all of the transmission capacity we can so that these generators can sell cheap power because, if they can't make money, then they're going out of business and we don't have that power anymore.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. We in Canada are peeking over the border at what's going on in the US because what you're going through now will be our fate in 5 years. There's no way that Canada, it's wonderful that we've had decades and decades of stable, low cost, clean electricity. We're like 84% zero emission between hydro and nuclear. And, that's all great. But once you start to double and triple things, it's gloves off, right? It just becomes chaos because you're trying to build it and manage it. And I mean, things are just changing so rapidly where you are, and that's going to be our fate in not that many years. So my takeaway from this is that the US is going to do a wonderful job of adopting all this great technology, like the grid enhancing technologies, and you're going to figure this out and retain that wonderful economic leadership that allows us to sell you all of our lumber and our oil and gas and all those that good stuff. And so on that cheery note, on a Friday afternoon, Julia, thank you very much for this.
Well, thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure.